We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now that's what I call science.
You're listening to That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio and podcast show that brings independent and interesting STEM, that's science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine, to you from Tasmania. The show is supported by Edge Radio, Hobart's premium youth station, so head to edge.org.au for more info. I'd like to begin today's episode by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording, the Palawa and Pakana, as we record on Lutruwita. And as we are a podcast, we would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land where you, the listener, are tuning in from. On behalf of everyone here in the studio, I pay my respects to elders past and present. My name is Hannah Moore, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Emma Hamasaki. I'll hand over to Emma to introduce our guest.
Thanks, Hannah, and welcome listeners to the third episode of the Geoscience mini-series, a four-part series where we talk to the most fantastic geoscientists based in Tasmania. Our expert guest today is Dr. Indrani Mukherjee. Indrani Mukherjee is a geology lecturer and researcher at the University of New South Wales. Originally from India, where she earned her Bachelor of Science Honours and Masters in Geology at the University of Delhi. She completed her PhD at UTAS in 2018, where she worked as a lecturer and postdoctoral researcher until 2022. She then went on to pursue the Roger E. Dean Fellowship at the University of Toronto. Indrani's research delves into the connections between early Earth's evolution, the emergence of complex life, and the formation of valuable mineral deposits. These pivotal studies offer crucial insights into our planet's history and potential future amidst rapidly changing climates.
So, Indrani, would you mind just telling us a little bit more about yourself, including what inspired you to pursue a career in geology?
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. So, so I've been interested in geoscience for the last 10 years or so. But I have to say, when I first started my undergrads in geology at the University of Delhi, I was very determined to not pursue a career in geoscience whatsoever, because I think geology is one of those subjects that was never taught to me in schools, and we had no idea about earth sciences in general during my high school. And the reason I took up geology was just so I could get a graduation degree in a so-called easy subject, so I could do other things in the meantime. But everything changed because of my fantastic teacher at the University of Delhi. He taught, his name is Professor Mihir Deb, and he taught us economic geology. And I am still interested in economic geology, but he didn't just inspire us to be economic geologists, but it was more to understand problems in geoscience as a whole. And because of his fantastic teaching, you kind of looked at the landscape around you very differently, because he kind of encapsulated all parts of geosciences into economic geology so well that you started looking at the environment around you completely differently. And that really inspired me to continue the subject on the first place. So I was very fortunate to have some really excellent teachers during my undergrad years. Not so much in the first year. I think we really need good teachers in our first year. But yeah, I would attribute my career interest in geoscience purely to my teachers at the University of Delhi.
Wow, that's such an amazing story. And I love hearing things like that when you have a mentor that really kind of inspires you and helps open your eyes to all these different pathways that, you know, you didn't foresee for yourself originally. Going back a little bit on your research topic, can you explain a little bit more about the connections between early Earth evolution, the emergence of complex life, and the formation of valuable mineral deposits?
Yes, so this is a very fascinating sort of interdisciplinary mixture of geoscience topics, I would say. And this all started because I did my PhD on a particular time span in Earth's history, infamously known as the Boring Billion, but it's actually the sort of early to middle and late Proterozoic. We are thinking, or we're talking about, say, 2000 to 1000 million years ago. And before I started my PhD, as you do a literature review of everything before you start any project, you realize that that particular time span in Earth's history was known to somehow stall biological evolution. And so I had to look into what the conditions were and whether or not it was boring to begin with, etc., etc. But it was during my PhD I realized that this time span actually signifies a lot more than initially recognized or acknowledged. And that's where you actually see that beautiful intersection of mineral deposits, evolution of complex life, and ocean chemistry, because that particular time span was very, very important for the origins of complex life. And part of my PhD was to understand what was the ocean chemistry like back in that time, and how did that influence the origins of complex life. And fascinatingly enough, that time span also is known to host some of the world's largest zinc-lead deposits. So then you had to kind of understand ocean chemistry from several different angles to see, well, what caused the origins of complex life, and what, on the other hand, also helped form and preserve some of the largest zinc-lead deposits, which are obviously very important today for our transition to net zero as well. But it was just understanding the rocks. So the ones that I study are specifically marine rocks that will have deposited in our oceans, you know, billions of years ago. So I focus specifically between 2000 to 1000 million years, looking at the marine ocean chemistry and what that meant for evolution of complex life and sort of formation and preservation of these mineral deposits. So yeah, there was a lot of angles to my PhD, and I've kind of built on that over the years after my PhD as well. So it's a fascinating time span to work on, for sure.
Yeah, amazing that we also can study those things, you know, that happened so many billions of years ago. Because I'm a more visual person, I'm trying to picture what this world would have looked like.
So whatever I will be saying is based on my research, of course. It's very hard to be absolutely confident what happened billions of years ago. But the beauty of our field of geoscience is that, you know, we can literally travel back in time if we look at the rocks carefully and try and understand what they're trying to tell us. So remember I told you that the time span that I was working on is known as the Boring Billion, and that's because past studies had shown that the oceans were quite depleted in some of the key bioessential elements that are required for all life forms. So Earth is 4.56 billion years old. We can be reasonably confident that the first life form, which is a very simple life form — I say the word simple, but there's nothing simple about them really — it's prokaryotic life form, or something like a bacterial cell. So that kind of life, prokaryotes, they are still the most, you know, the major domain of life even today. You know, we've got more prokaryotes on our body right now than the number of our own cells. So they're quite major, but we had sort of that kind of life form to begin with. But at some point in Earth's history, and as it happens, it is in that Boring Billion period that we had the origins of the very complex cell, 34 trillion of which you and I are made of as well. So I wanted to see what caused that transition from a very simple cell to a very complex one that all complex organisms on Earth are made of. So we started off with very small microbial prokaryotic life forms, so like bacteria, and then during the Boring Billion, we started the origins of complex life. Now, biologists know how the first complex cell came about. So it's debated whether two simple cells got together in a friendly endosymbiotic relationship, or maybe one cell ingested the other to then evolve into a complex. So when I say complex cell, we have to remember that the cells you and I are made up of, they have various little cell organelles within that cell, and that's what makes it complex. So the cell is compartmentalized, and each of those compartments perform specialized functions, which is why you and I and other macroscopic or bigger organisms are, you know, quite complex, and we are bigger in size as well. So this compartmentalization occurred, you know, as one simple cell started ingesting others, or one started living within the other, and that evolved over time. So biologists can speculate how it may have come about, but as a geologist, I'm trying to answer why. Why did it happen? If those simple cells were perfectly capable of living independently, as they do even today, then why would two cells have any sort of interaction? And I think the reason that I proposed in one of our research publications was that our oceans witnessed a significant depletion in nutrient concentrations. By that I mean all the key elements that are required by life forms were severely depleted. And this is the first time in Earth's history that we see this really significant drop in nutrient levels. And we know that because we've looked at the rocks that were deposited in the oceans back then, and they, as rocks are, very faithfully, they will record the conditions in which they are being deposited. So when you look at the marine chemistry through time, you can see that there's this significant drop in nutrient concentrations. So it wasn't that nutrients weren't there at all, but it dropped significantly, and that must have fueled the need for interactions. It's a bit like during COVID, how businesses had to reorient themselves and figure out innovative ways to somehow survive through the lockdowns. And I think that's exactly what happened with the organisms there. So despite everything happening at a very micro level, so these organisms, like you asked, they're very tiny, 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 but still very, very significant in terms of evolution. And I think that went a bit unrecognized, and everyone thought, oh, you know, you can't see dinosaurs, you can't see, you know, funky big trilobites, so yeah, things must have been incredibly boring. But I think things happen, significant things happen in terms of microbial evolution, which is the foundation of our biosphere today.
Stick with us for part two as we chat more with Indrani about her work exploring the connections between early Earth evolution, the emergence of complex life, and the formation of valuable mineral deposits. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and today we are talking about Earth's ancient ocean chemistry. My name is Emma Hamasaki, and I'm joined by Hannah Moore alongside our expert guest, Indrani Mukherjee.
Indrani, could you please tell us a little bit about the geochemical analytical techniques that you use in your research?
Yes, so there are a few that I've been using in the past few years. One of my favorites is the laser ablation technique, and it sounds very cool, and it actually is very cool. It's a bit different to a conventional technique. So initially what we did was we got our rock sample and we crushed it all into a powder, and then we analyzed it for the various elements that we're interested in using the mass spectrometer. But with the laser ablation, we have this added advantage that we could target specific areas within your sample that are important to you. So, for me, it was very important to understand the chemistry of this mineral called pyrite in our rocks, because it's the pyrite and the structure of pyrite that basically absorbs all these different elements that are available around it. So it's an excellent measure of all the bioessential key elements that might have been hanging around when that particular mineral was forming. So if I'm looking at a rock, so rocks will have all different kinds of pyrites and they will have formed in different conditions. But the ones that formed during when the rock was being deposited, in other words, capturing the original seawater chemistry, those pyrites are very different to the pyrites that will form when that particular sediment is being lithified and been through diagenesis and through the whole rock cycle. So it was very important for me to screen out specific textures of particular minerals to have a proper insight into availability of certain elements. And so the laser technique allows me to select specific parts of the rock and then ablate them. And we're talking, you know, you could go down to 10 microns, which is like tiny. And so there's like a laser pulse that's, I don't know, the lowest I've ever gone is really 10. But usually it's 10 to 20 microns. You can literally ablate that tiny little bit of the pyrite or whichever mineral that you're after and just analyze that very bit. That's how far we've gone. And I think we're going to see more techniques come around, really. But that's one of the techniques I've been using. Obviously, most of the conventional techniques, of course, as well, like whole rock ICP-MS techniques, they're all crazy. We love our acronyms, geologists. They're all incredibly boring acronyms, but yep, we love them. The one that I would love to share is recently I've been working on synchrotron techniques. That is like pretty mind-blowing, and it's like an sort of an electron beam that's been rotated at the speed of light, and then finally it hits your samples and it gives you detail, unprecedented level of detail of your sample. So I'm looking at some ammonites that have been remineralized by pyrites. So the aim of the project is to see what's what was once a life form and has been completely remineralized. Can we still, are there still any biosignatures left? Because we're looking for signs of life on Mars. And so if there's a fossil on Mars, then it's a dead giveaway that there was once life. But if it was once a life form but now has been completely remineralized, which happens all the time, then is there any way of saying that this was once a life form? So that's the premise of the project. And so we need to look at, you know, very high level, by high level I mean, you know, rather zoomed in versions of these fossils that have been completely remineralized to see if there are still some characteristics that signify that this was once a life form. So I'm working on ammonites, so I know that we know ammonites were life forms. So I could then apply the results of the techniques to other things that look like fossil, but we're not quite sure if they are. So the synchrotron techniques are quite mind-blowing.
Absolutely. I've been on the synchrotron a couple of times, and it really is just pretty groundbreaking technology.
What do you hope the future holds for your research and its impact on our understanding of early Earth and life's evolution?
Yes, so that's a really good question. I have, I think like most geologists, we love going back in time, and the information is already there in the rocks. It's just about us finding that information. And so we've got 4.56 billion years of history in our rocks, and we are only just scratching the surface. And so, you know, we need a steady pool of geoscientists working on these various fundamental aspects of geoscience. So I, for example, love working on evolution of early complex life. But, you know, one could always ask me, why are you studying that? So what? They evolved such and such. It's a fascinating piece of information, but what are the main applications of such research? And I think I've been thinking about that for the last few years a lot more. And I think the better we understand Earth's past, because there are lots of studies today trying to understand Earth's present. As you know, there's a lot of research on how our climate is changing, how our environments are being affected, and we are collecting lots and lots of data for how things have changed in the past 100 years in terms of carbon dioxide emissions and greenhouse gas emissions. And I think they're all extremely valuable, but I think if we are to use the information about Earth today, we absolutely need to understand how it's come to this point. And we can only do that if we understand our past really well. Because if you don't have that context, then anything that we predict for the future is not going to be as accurate as we want it to be.
Stick with us, listeners, for part three as we chat with Indrani about engaging students and young people in earth sciences. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and we are talking about early Earth evolution, the emergence of complex life, the formation of valuable mineral deposits. My name is Emma Hamasaki, and I'm joined by Hannah Moore, along with our expert guest, Indrani Mukherjee.
Indrani, you were recently featured in an ABC interview with the title, Where is the Taylor Swift of Geology? Can you give us a bit of background on this, and what point were you trying to get across?
First of all, thank you so much for asking this question. I'm so glad that I'm finally on record explaining what actually happened. So, the title was not my idea. It was Robin Williams, who is well known to host ABC's Science Show. He came up with that brilliant title, and I think it is a great title. But I certainly I'm not the Taylor Swift of geology. I want to be on record saying that. I think what happened was, the story behind it, I think we were discussing how we can get young people to do anything, younger generation to do anything. And I think I was very sure of my answer to Robin. And I said, look, if you want young people to do anything, you've got to do what Taylor Swift is doing. And I know that for a fact because I'd like younger people to pursue geosciences. But I think traditionally the way we've gone about it is not going to work. And we have to learn whatever she's doing is obviously working extremely well for her. And really, I think that was the sort of crux of our discussion. But I would like to dwell on it a little bit, given that she's so massively popular these days. I think we really need that kind of phenomenon. I think it's not for one person to be. It's not like we need one person who can be a Taylor Swift-like persona in geosciences. I think I would call the Taylor Swift a phenomenon, really, a sort of thing that you need in geosciences, because we don't market ourselves really well. We have the most incredible content of all sciences, not that other sciences don't have any content, but we have equally good content. Incredible, actually. But we just don't market it well. And we like keeping to ourselves. You know, you'll find a David Attenborough, you'll find a Brian Cox. You'd never find any, you know, geos doing that kind of stuff. And I think we all need to get out there. It's not for one person. I think everyone should be mindful of whatever they're working on and try and articulate to anyone and everyone, what exactly are they doing? I tell my students the same thing, that you're doing honours with me or whatever, undergrad. When you go back home and your parents ask you, please don't tell them you're characterising rocks. And it won't make any sense. You have to, you know, distill it into information that's relevant to them. If you can't articulate to your own family what you're working on, then it's probably, I don't know why you're doing it. So make sure you... So I think we need to change the way we talk about our research, our work, because I think that's what she's doing as well. She's, you know, she's got a whole life laid out in songs and everything. And, you know, while you might not agree to one bits of it, there are other bits that are very relatable.
I really like that. We've come to the end of this episode, but thanks, listeners. Thank you for listening to That's What I Call Science. We love bringing you science-related content and hope you enjoyed the show. If you loved the show, then you can get in touch with us by searching That's What I Call Science or That's Science Taz on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. My name is Hannah Moore, and I'd like to thank my co-host Emma Hamasaki and our expert guest Indrani Mukherjee. We hope you have a wonderful week.
This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. That's What I Call Science is brought to your station and across the nation via the Community Radio Network. You can find the show at all major podcast streaming services and find out more about us from our social media channels. Make sure you like and subscribe to keep up with all the exciting science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine research in Lutruwita, Tasmania. This show is supported and strengthened by Edge Radio, so head over to edgeradio.org.au for more information about them. Thanks for tuning in today, and may your week be STEMtastic. We'll be right back.